It's 6 hours, Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa, coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Europe's migration crisis continues unabated. Migrants by the hundreds continue making their way across southern and eastern Europe en route to Austria and Germany as European officials try to cope with the worst migration crisis since the Second World War.
Notre responsabilité à tous.
French Prime Minister Manuel Valls says it's the responsibility of all Europeans to ensure the right of asylum. Those, he says, who are persecuted in their country, who are facing torture, who are oppressed, must be welcomed. Austria blocked a Munich-bound train Monday at the Hungarian borders. Authorities searched for human traffickers and questioned hundreds of migrants, most of them from Syria, about proper credentials. Vienna tightened security checks after the bodies of more than 70 migrants were discovered last week in Austria in an abandoned truck. The United States Monday expressed concern over the pending visit to China by Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir, who remains under International Criminal Court indictment for the genocide in Darfur. Mr. Bashir is expected to travel to China to take part in 70th anniversary events marking the end of the Second World War. Mark Toner is a U.S. spokesman.
As you know, he's been charged with by the ICC, International Criminal Court, with war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide, and warrants for his arrest remain outstanding, and we strongly support the ICC's efforts to hold accountable those responsible for those acts. We oppose invitations, facilitation, or support for travel by persons subject to outstanding ICC warrants.
While traveling frequently across Africa, Mr. Bashir has rarely ventured so far as China. In June, he narrowly escaped a court hearing while in South Africa. He's expected to try to attend the UN General Assembly session in New York in September. This is VOA News. The United Nations says satellite photos confirm Islamic State blew up another ancient temple in the historic Syrian city Palmyra. A UN agency posted images of the Temple of Bel taken August 27 and the same site taken Monday, a day after Syrian observers said the temple had been destroyed by an explosion. Greg Barton is a terror expert at Australia's Deakin University.
They do this partly for profit reasons. Those things that are too big to move, they blow up for propaganda reasons. We are dealing, of course, with a very cynical, instrumental terrorist state, but also an apocalyptic cult. So they get good value from the propaganda of blowing up pagan temples, and we can expect this to carry on as long as Islamic State is holding ancient Mesopotamia.
The Temple of Bel is nearly 2,000 years old. Syrians consider it to be one of the country's most important religious shrines. A Turkish court has ordered two British journalists and their interpreter remanded to custody ahead of an eventual trial on charges of engaging in terror activity. The journalists were arrested near the borders with Syria, Iraq, and Iran. Security sources said correspondent Jake Hanrahan and cameraman Philip Pendlebury were reporting without proper government accreditation as they filmed fighting between Turkish forces and Kurdish militants. Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko late Monday denounced a violent nationalist demonstration against legislation granting more autonomy to pro-Russian separatists in the east. A security officer was killed, dozens of other law enforcement personnel injured by a grenade blast. Mr. Poroshenko says defeat of the legislation would undermine a pro-Ukrainian coalition. A Western-backed peace plan agreed to earlier this year calls for Kiev to adopt decentralization by year's end. The protesters call the reforms un-Ukrainian, saying the constitutional changes would effectively legalize the rebel control of eastern Ukraine. An opposition coalition in Ivory Coast Monday invited President Alassane Ouattara to discuss conditions for upcoming elections. Otherwise, the coalition says it will block the October ballot. President Ouattara, riding strong support with an economy that is improving, is favored to win the ballot for a second term. The opposition National Coalition for Change, formed in May, led by former Prime Minister Charles Konambani, expressed concern about insecurity, which could hamper voting, and probe government bias in voting register and the Electoral Commission. An explosion at a chemical factory in eastern China killed at least one person. Pictures on Chinese social media today show a large fireball rising from what appeared to be an industrial area in Dongying, located in the eastern province of Shandong province. The incident comes less than a month after a much larger explosion killed nearly 160 at a chemical storage facility in the northern port city Tianjin. Authorities detained a dozen company employees and 11 officials in that investigation. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Tuesday, September 1st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. A former U.S. official calls for a robust U.N. role to stabilize South Sudan.
The U.N. must come in there massively to give security to the people. That's first priority. Secondly, we have to do what we did in Namibia when they were becoming independent. Many civil servants came from New York to help them run government departments.
Ambassador Herman Cohen is the former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. South Sudan's government approved the recent peace agreement to end the country's 20-month-old civil war. Meanwhile, rebels call for Ugandan and all other foreign troops to leave South Sudan. And Liberians want to know how money allocated to fight Ebola was spent.
Government said they were paying health workers salaries of $500, salaries plus incentives. And that is not the reality.
George Williams is Secretary General of the National Health Workers Association of Liberia. The Democratic Republic of Congo tries mega farms to feed its population. And the UN gives a grim outlook for food security in Somalia. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs Herman Cohen says he's pessimistic South Sudan's new peace agreement would lead to a lasting peace. He called for a robust U.N. involvement to stabilize the country in the form of a large U.N. peacekeeping force, as well as technical experts to help run key government departments like finance. Ambassador Cohen's comments came as rebel leader Riek Machar Monday accused South Sudan government of violating the latest ceasefire, which came into effect last Saturday. Ambassador Cohen blamed what he called colonial powers for not preparing South Sudanese enough to run their own affairs after independence.
They were not prepared because all of the colonial powers just totally ignored them. The British never did anything in the South, and when the Arab government in Khartoum became independent, they did nothing for the South. Just look at it. There's very few roads, very few institutions, very few clinics, very few schools. So I call South Sudan pre-colonial. So many African governments were able to benefit from contact with colonial power, sending their people to school in the UK and France, and they had people coming in doing good things, but South Sudan was zero. They got nothing from colonialism. So they started out really with not much, and unfortunately, the leadership that got elected really was the worst kind. They were very corrupt. And all they cared about was stealing money from the oil, and they did nothing for the people. Think of this. After the first year in power, the new government, there were 600 generals in the army. Can you imagine a small army in South Sudan with 600 generals? That's more than the United States has. So all they cared about was money. And then, of course, they started fighting among themselves. And the poor people are suffering more now than they did under the Sudanese regime.
Are you at all optimistic about this latest deal, of one of many which has been signed? And then, of course,
I pray to God at night that this deal will be upheld. But I'm very skeptical and pessimistic. It's the same people who are going to implement it. And some of the warlords already have said they're not part of it. I give you my solution, which nobody cares about, is the UN must come in there massively. They must bring in lots of blue helmets to give security to the people. That's first priority. Secondly, we have to do what we did in Namibia when they were becoming independent. Many civil servants came from New York to help them run government departments, run the treasury, run the budget, not just run it, but teach them how to do it. So after 18 months, the Namibians were ready to govern themselves. And this is what South Sudan needs.
President Salva Kiir repeatedly says that he was signing the agreement with reservations. And one of the reasons for his reservations has been the idea of giving up South Sudan's sovereignty. So if the UN sends troops there or peacekeepers there, wouldn't South Sudan be giving up its sovereignty?
Well, just temporarily, but he would still be president. He would still be making the major decisions. I'm not talking about people coming in and giving him orders, but people coming in and helping him to run the various departments, experts. That's what I'm not talking about, people who run things, but experts to help them run things.
Ambassador Herman Cohen is the former U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. He was speaking with Carol Castile and me on VOA's Press Conference USA, where we interview him about his new book, The Mind of the African Strongman. We'll have more of Mr. Cohen's interview on this program in the days to come. The South Sudan government has approved the agreement signed last week to end 20 months of fighting between government forces and rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar. The approval was given during last Friday's weekly Council of Ministers meeting, chaired by Vice President James Mwani Iga. Philipton Aller of VOA South Sudan in Focus program reports from Juba.
Speaking to reporters, government spokesman Michael Makwe said cabinet ministers unanimously approved the peace deal that Mr. Kiir signed 2 days earlier.
The Council of Ministers applauded the bold and courageous decision taken by His Excellency the President by signing the peace agreement so that people of South Sudan can live in peace and stop all these killings and fighting.
The cabinet decision to approve the peace deal is a U-turn from 2 weeks ago when Riek Machar signed the IGAD brokered deal for the armed opposition and Pagana Mom signed for the group of former political detainees. Then government ministers described the agreement as a sellout and a bad deal for South Sudan. Rallies against the deal were staged across the country, but the tone changed when President Kiir added his signature to the deal last Wednesday. Under the terms of the peace agreement, a new position of first vice president in a transitional government of national unity will be created and occupied by someone from the armed opposition led by former Vice President Riek Machar. Current Vice President James Mwani Iga will be the third in command when the transitional government is formed. By signing the agreement, the government and the armed opposition also agreed to draw down troop numbers and establish demilitarized areas, a monitoring and verification mechanism that was set up during the conflict to report on breaches of earlier ceasefire agreements will be expanded now that peace has been agreed. Both sides have already abided by one of the key provisions of the peace deal and declared a ceasefire. Makwe says the government is committed to fully implementing the deal.
And call upon the people of South Sudan to stand behind the president and support him so that we can move towards the implementation of this agreement, especially at a time when he had also gone further and declared a permanent ceasefire.
When Mr. Kiir signed the deal, he released a long list of reservations that the government has with the agreement. The international community has said it rejects those reservations, and the United Nations Security Council has threatened to impose sanctions and an arms embargo on South Sudan if the conditions and complaints are not dropped by tomorrow. For VOA News, I am Philipton Aller in Juba.
A South Sudan rebel delegation led by former Vice President Riek Machar met this past weekend with Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni to talk about how the new peace deal would be implemented. A rebel spokesman says his group expects Ugandan and all other foreign forces to withdraw from South Sudan within 45 days as stipulated in the agreement. Bonifacio Taban of VOA South Sudan in Focus program reports from Kampala.
Rebels said they met President Museveni in Kampala on Saturday following an invitation. The Ugandan leader, we came after President Kiir signed deal last week. Opposition deputy leader Alfred Ladogore led the 12-member delegations. Rebel spokesman Stephen Farr said the group urged Ugandan officials to play a positive role in ending the fightings.
The current leadership has contributed very positively in this process, and we have come to thank them and also encourage them to support us in the implementation process.
Shortly after fighting broke out in Juba on December 15, 2013, the Ugandan army was deployed in South Sudan at the request of President Salva Kiir. Farr said despite Ugandan direct involvement in the conflicts, the rebel have no more quarrel with Kampala.
Let it be known that the SPLM-SPLA leadership under the able leadership of Dr. Riek Machar does not hold any grudges against the Republic of Uganda and the leadership. We are saying for us to implement this peace agreement, we must put everything behind us. Let's focus on how to implement this agreement. And we need the support of the Ugandan leadership.
Ugandan Minister of Foreign Affairs Enir Oyems Okello said last week that Ugandan is not bound by the IGAD peace agreement. FAR insists Ugandan is bound by the agreement and said Uganda should withdraw its troops from South Sudan within the time frame is stipulated in the peace deal.
You know that comprehensive agreement we signed is very clear. One of the provisions is that the Ugandan troops, not only Ugandan troops, all the foreign allied forces in the country, whether they are supporting the opposition or the government, the provision is very clear that they will leave within 45 days.
FAR said he is confident Ugandan will abide by the agreements and remove its troops from South Sudan within the 45 days period. For BOA News, I'm Boniface Yetaban in Kampala.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, the first day of September. Let's give a shout out to listeners on our affiliate station, Radio Hot Cocoa in Bamenda, Cameroon. Daybreak Africa time, 16 minutes past the hour. As the Ebola virus outbreak diminishes in Liberia, unions and civil society groups are beginning to question how the government spent money allocated to fight the outbreak. Christine reports.
Liberia is expected to be declared once again free of the Ebola virus later this week. But people are starting to question what happened to all the money allocated to fight the outbreak. Over 4,800 Liberians died from the disease since its outbreak in the country in 2014. The country was declared free of the disease in May, but it reemerged weeks later. International donors pledged hundreds of millions of dollars to help the impoverished country fight the virus. Lami Pargoy, the head of civil society group Liberia Media Center, says his group has launched a project to account for how that money was spent.
So we are looking at every funding that came in to respond to the Ebola outbreak, whether it's is doing an actual outbreak or doing a post-outbreak situation.
Some are already crying foul. Health workers have recently taken to the streets of the capital, Monrovia, saying they have not been paid by the government for work they did during the outbreak, like contact tracing, where they find people who came into contact with Ebola patients. George Williams is the Secretary General of the National Health Workers Association of Liberia.
Government said they were paying health workers salaries of $500, salaries plus incentives. And that is not the reality.
Adolphus Ye, a health officer from Margibi County outside the capital, says the local government relies on foreign donors to pay the salaries of its volunteers and contact tracers, money it has not received.
We do not have the resources to pay contact tracers. We have not paid contact tracers.
A new death from Ebola was reported in Sierra Leone on Monday and will likely be months before the two other West African countries hit hard by the outbreak, Sierra Leone and Guinea, are declared free of the virus. Chris Stein for VOA News, Lagos.
A shortage of meningitis C vaccine is making it harder to combat an outbreak in Nigeria, even before the traditional meningitis season hits in January. Already this year, there have been 12,000 cases and 800 deaths in Nigeria and Niger, according to the World Health Organization. Dr. Goswell Okara is the former head of Nigeria's Association of Medical Laboratory Scientists and current chairman of the West African Postgraduate College of Medical Laboratory Science. He tells Ricky Stryak that Nigeria should once again start producing its own vaccine, such as the meningitis C, to help stem future outbreaks.
We were producing some viral vaccines in the past. Curiously enough, the government of Nigeria, for one reason or the other, preferred to import vaccines rather than upgrade the facilities for production in Nigeria. For example, the vaccine production laboratory in Lagos was producing millions of doses of yellow fever vaccine and anti-rabies vaccine. So all of a sudden, the government abandoned the laboratory. Went into dilapidation. As we speak, we import a lot of yellow fever and rabies vaccines into Nigeria from abroad.
Do you think if this vaccine laboratory was up and running, they could be making vaccine for meningitis C? Currently, there's an epidemic of this disease right now in Nigeria.
Certainly, if the laboratory is up and running, we'll be able to produce vaccine. As we speak, medical laboratory scientists are producing 18 different animal vaccines in the National Veterinary Research Institute in Nigeria. So if we can produce animal vaccines in export quantity, it's the same principle. It doesn't involve rocket science, something that we can produce human vaccines if the vaccine production laboratory were functional.
Do you think it's a question of funding or is it a question of just willpower?
It's a question of lack of political will. You know, during the oil boom in Nigeria in the 80s and part of 90s, they preferred to import virtually everything. Even toothpick was imported into Nigeria. So as professionals, we feel very bad about it. The smallpox vaccine that was used in eradicating smallpox in the late 70s in Nigeria and in the West African sub-region was produced from the vaccine production lab in Lagos.
So not only could a vaccine production lab in Lagos potentially help this meningitis C outbreak, but do you think it could help other outbreaks, epidemics?
Yes, certainly. We have been advocating that there is need for Nigeria to produce meningitis vaccine since Nigeria is one of the 26 countries within the meningitis belt. Just as we produce millions of doses of smallpox vaccine for use in the West African sub-region, we can similarly produce meningitis vaccine for use in the entire meningitis belt in sub-Saharan Africa.
That was Dr. Gaswell Okara, chairman of the West African Postgraduate College of Medical Laboratory Science. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from southeastern Nigeria. The Democratic Republic of Congo is trying out a large-scale agricultural plan, that is to say, the least ambitious. The government plans to develop one mega farm of 50,000 to 150,000 hectares per province, producing food for local consumption as well as export crops. The government says the aim is to promote food security. Nick Long visited the most advanced of these farms at Bukanga Lonzo, about 150 kilometers from Kinshasa, and filed this report.
The park at Bukanga Lonzo currently has 5,000 hectares under cultivation. The site is on a plateau, and already crops stretch as far as the eye can see. Isaac Saleh, who works as an economist at the Prime Minister's office, says they are harvesting about 3,300 hectares of that land. Most of the production at these mega farms will be mechanised, but there will be some 7,000 jobs created on the farm in the near future, says the government. The employees will be working full-time to cultivate and harvest vegetables, irrigated by sprinklers rotating on 20 huge pivots. Each pivot is the length of a football pitch, says Saleh, and it's big enough that vegetables under the pivot can be planted and harvested every day. The food is intended for Kinshasa, says the government, and should help to cut down on the $1.5 billion the DRC pays each year for food imports. Under these plans, Bukanga Lonzo will also be a new town, with processing industries and many other jobs. The government says it has already spent $100 million on infrastructure for the park and the town, mainly on a power grid, a water pumping station and productive machinery. John Olimwengu, the Prime Minister's chief agricultural advisor, told VOA the agro-industrial park model will be replicated in other provinces. Currently, the government is the majority shareholder at Bukanga Lonzo and is leasing land to investors for 25 years. Olimwengu explained why the government is concentrating so many resources on specific farms.
You cannot do agriculture everywhere in a country. So we thought that it was much easier to develop a site investment ready instead of country investment ready. Because on a specific site, the government can create the environment that is required to attract investors.
An agronomist at a development center near Bukanga Lonzo, Clement Mwembia, is critical of that approach.
Vous allez voir que les investissements qu'ils ont fait dans les parcs agro-industriels.
The $100 million is a colossal amount that could have been spent on local communities, he says, and that would have served the population. If the investment they have made in agro-industrial parks had been spent on small-scale family farmers, you would be seeing more high-quality staple foods in the market, he says. But Olimwengu argues that's not realistic.
Let me be honest. If 80 or so percent of your population is involved in agriculture and they cannot feed 30% of the population, means that it's not done in an efficient way. So there are a lot of them that should be in doing something else.
Beyond having up to 11 mega farms, the government also plans to have smaller agricultural development centres of 200 to 300 hectares across the country. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
It's coming up at 25 minutes past the hour. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Mark Owoma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with basketball. Nigeria earned their maiden Africa men's basketball title on Sunday. Affectionately known as the Tigers among their adoring fans, Nigeria outwitted defending champions Angola 74-65 in the Africa men's basketball championship final in the Tunisian capital, Tunis. The Tigers' triumph is a culmination of persistence since the first African championships in Cairo, Egypt in 1962. They were runners-up in 1997 and 1999 to hosts Senegal and Angola, respectively. In 2003, they lost in the finals to Angola in Alexandria, Egypt. The Tigers were bronze medalists in 1995 and 2005 when the contest was staged in the Algerian capital, Algiers. In 2011, the Tigers were bronze medalists in Antananarivo, Madagascar. Staying in Tunis, local fans had something to cheer as Tunisia outplayed Senegal 82-73 in the bronze medal playoff on Sunday. Egypt edged Algeria 69-63 in the fifth place playoff. Mali outplayed Gabon 94-82 in the seventh place playoff. Cameroon dismissed Cape Verde Islands 88-68 to secure ninth place. Mozambique are 11th after they outplayed Ivory Coast 70-63 in the 13th place playoff. Morocco beat the Central African Republic 86-74, while in the duel among tournament debutants, Uganda outplayed Zimbabwe 72-64 to place 15th. Still in Tunis, African champions and Nigeria the Tigers have earned an automatic berth to the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympics in Brazil. Angola, Tunisia, and Senegal will be among 15 countries vying for the three wild card spots up for grabs at a qualifier to be organized by the World Basketball Governing Body, FIBA, in the second week of July next year. Turning to volleyball, African champions Kenya play Algeria at the Women's World Volleyball Championships in Okayama, Japan today, Tuesday. Having lost all their matches in the first round and the first in the second round, both teams are looking for their first win at the tournament. Finally, Iran edged Egypt by 3-2 as Argentina similarly pipped Tunisia 3-2 at the World Men's Under-23 Championship in Dubai, United Arab Emirates on Saturday. Consequently, Egypt and Tunisia tie in ninth place in the contest that was won by Russia, with Turkey second and Italy third. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a great day. Here's our listener mail for this Tuesday morning, September the 1st.
This is Bapa Adanare Fota from Gombe local government area of Adamawa State, Nigeria. Nigerians, it is good to understand that it is better to live in peace than to live in pieces. For peace and stability, the minority should not force to rule, and the majority should neither deny the minority from ruling nor overrule the minority. This is Bapa Adamare Fota from Gombe local government area of Adamawa State, Nigeria. Thank you.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us in the United States at 202-205-9942, and that's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. That is it for this Tuesday, September 1st edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford and reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, I am James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good day.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, AGOA, the African Growth and Opportunity Act, has been passed, signed, and reauthorized for the next decade, ensuring U.S. African trade and investment will continue to flourish. Next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on Straight Talk Africa, host Shaka Sali and his guests will discuss the outcome of the AGOA joint conference held in Gabon. That's next time on VOA Africa. Voice of America's news, talk, and music programs are now at the tip of your fingers. Find everything at www.voaafrica.com. Listen to VOA's program lineup live, anytime, day or night. Pick out your favorite shows and listen anytime you want. Download our podcasts. Check VOA Mobile from your cell phone Subscribe to VOA News Feeds. voanews.com.